Hello, and welcome back to the Daycare Diaries. In our last episode, we looked at attachment theory and how daycares can support this process. For this episode, I want to widen our lens a bit. It's not useful to look at psychology in a vacuum because psychology never occurs in a vacuum. Today, we're going to look at childcare facilities as a resource for vulnerable groups. And to understand this, we're going to talk about early views of psychology, risk factors and protective factors, and the populations that are affected. Welcome to episode 2, Risk. As you may have discerned from my last episode, some aspects of attachment theory encourage an unproductive depiction of motherhood, and they tend to push the narrative that time spent in a daycare facility ruptures the bond between the child and the mother. And this isn't an uncommon thought throughout the history of psychology, and it's contributed to a flawed understanding of what causes psychological disorders. Psychologists have asked what causes mental illness for decades, and in the past, their answer to this question was very linear. A led to B. This is called a closed system. Take, for example, the schizophrenogenic mother. Frieda Fromm-Reichmann, who was known for coining that term, schizophrenogenic mother, stated, "The schizophrenic is painfully distrustful and resentful of other people due to the severe early warp and rejection he encountered in important people in his infancy and childhood, as a rule, mainly the schizophrenogenic mother." In this case, A caused B. An unloving mother caused her child to grow up and develop schizophrenia. Oftentimes, this theory places the failure of a mother at the center of these closed systems. And we see this not only in the early literature surrounding attachment, but also in the modern public opinion of mothers. It's their fault for having a C-section instead of a natural birth. It's their fault for bottle feeding instead of breastfeeding. It's their fault for sending their child to daycare. It's their fault for working. It's their fault for coddling their child too much. Especially on the internet, these perspectives rarely come from a place of concern for the child, but rather act as a tool to shame women for not living up to this idealized expectation of motherhood. Attachment theory has fueled many of these debates and acted as fodder for many internet debates regarding early childhood care. However, these mostly stem from the false assumption of a closed system. In reality, we know that there are many different factors that can lead to a psychological outcome, a concept called equifinality. Conversely, multifinality states that a variety of outcomes can come from one situation or factor. Think siblings. Despite being raised in the same environment with similar genes, the people they become can be wildly different or very similar. Factors that contribute to equifinality and multifinality start as far back as pregnancy. Prenatal experiences can greatly affect a child, and of course, there are the obvious examples of drinking or smoking while pregnant, which is associated with developmental issues and future outcomes of psychopathology. But a lot of people don't realize that a mother's experience also contributes to their unborn child's future. In particular, I'm referring to the effect a mother's stress level during pregnancy can have on a child. A lot of the work done in this field comes from correlational studies. In a true experiment, groups are randomly assigned to different conditions, but as you can imagine, it would be unethical to randomly assign a child to a condition that could potentially negatively impact the rest of their lives. One of these correlational studies was done on children in utero during the 1976 earthquake in Tangshan, China. 18 years later, these children were compared to another group of children born 1 year after the earthquake. They found that the 18-year-olds whose mothers were pregnant with them at the time of the earthquake experienced significantly higher rates of severe depression compared to the control group. Similar correlations have been made between experiencing a natural disaster or other type of trauma in utero and instances of schizophrenia. These results indicate to us that the child's brain is being altered during these traumatic events that happen while they're still in utero. This effect is not exclusive to traumatic natural disasters. It's also applicable to prenatal anxiety and depression. In fact, prenatal anxiety is associated with significantly stronger instances of antisocial behavior and developmental delays than other well-known teratogens, such as smoking. Studies performed using animal subjects are another way that we can ethically study prenatal effects on child development. One of these animal experiments is an experiment about prenatal stress performed on rats. In this experiment, a pregnant rat is placed in a tube and exposed to an inescapable bright light for 45 minutes, 3 times a day. The intention of this light is to induce stress. The exposed rat then produced antisocial offspring with increased glucocorticoid production, reduced neural proliferation, and trouble learning mazes. Once again, this mirrors what we know about human pregnancy. The level of stress experienced by the mother has a significant effect on the future well-being of the unborn child. But why does this happen? Let's revisit the idea of glucocorticoids that I talked about in the first episode. When we're stressed, we produce glucocorticoids. In the case of pregnant women, The glucocorticoids being produced are passing through the placenta and changing the intrauterine environment, affecting the development of the fetus's brain. This effect can manifest itself throughout multiple generations and acts as a risk factor for depression and PTSD. Looking at this from an intersectional lens, think about the populations that are most affected by this. Like I said earlier, we're quick to condemn mothers without fully understanding their circumstances or extending empathy. All of the stressors we've been talking about are risk factors for maladaptive outcomes, but the thing about risk factors is that they typically don't occur alone. Take, for example, a mother living in poverty. By the stressful nature of her situation, her child is likely already predisposed to reactionary behaviors from the stress hormones passing through the placenta. On top of that, many people living in poverty reside in food deserts or nearby dangerous chemical dump sites or other environmentally unsound areas. So nutritional deficiencies and health effects of nearby chemicals also become a factor acting on this child before he's even born. Once he's born, the risk factors don't lessen. The mother will likely need to work to support her family and will thus have to opt for daycare. And as we went over the last episode, the quality of daycare will also affect the child's well-being. Pausing this vignette to go back to the rat experiments, I want to talk about another condition that was run where the rat mother was exposed to the same unyielding light, but this time the offspring had access to enriched housing, non-stressed caregivers, and regular petting and holding. In this case, the rats actually showed the opposite results, having decreased glucocorticoid secretion, becoming more sociable, being better at mazes, and having increased neurogenesis. Which brings me to the topic of risk factors and protective factors. While risk factors increase the likelihood of negative outcomes, protective factors increase resiliency despite adversity. In the case of the rat experiment, both rats were exposed to the same risk factor, prenatal stress. However, the protective factors, being enriched housing and attentive caregivers, that the other rat was exposed to, offset the negative effects of the prenatal stress and produced a better outcome. The risk factors that act on a human child do not end after pregnancy. There are many environmental factors acting upon children that can likewise alter childhood development and behavior. One of these factors is childhood neglect, which is the most common form of childhood maltreatment. As with the importance of attachment, we tend to underestimate the importance of social and emotional enrichment for a child's development, enrichment that is achieved largely through engaged caretakers. When a child is neglected, they're not receiving stimulation in those areas, resulting in the dysfunction of the neurosystems responsible. Remember, a child's socio-emotional development occurs largely during the first 3 years. So if they're not being stimulated during this time frame, these parts of the brain will not develop correctly. A lot of the information we have about the effects of severe neglect comes from institutions with a large number of children, like orphanages. Let's look at the infamous example of Romanian orphanages. In 1966, after Nicolae Ceausescu had come to power, he decided to target the community's low birth rate, thinking that a higher birth rate would create more workers and lead to a flourishing economy. Unsurprisingly, Ceausescu's ban on birth control and abortions did more harm than good. While he did succeed at raising the country's population, without a supplementary economic infrastructure, parents couldn't take care of their children, resulting in orphanages becoming inundated with children. And due to the sheer number of children in these orphanages, the conditions they were subjected to were abysmal. In addition to not having adequate nourishment, they were often not clothed or attended to. And while this is an extreme example of neglect and abuse, it illustrates that such experiences have lasting effects not only on behavior, but also on brain structure and function. Studying these children's brains revealed significantly smaller masses of gray and white matter in the brain. In particular, these children had a thinner, uncinate fasciculus which connects the limbic structure to the prefrontal cortex. The limbic system is the emotional center of the brain, which is responsible for processing emotions such as fear and arousal. Located within the frontal lobe, the prefrontal cortex handles executive functioning, meaning it is responsible for impulse control, inhibition, reasoning, judgment, and planning. Thus, with the path between these two realms impacted, socio-emotional processing, self-regulation, and empathy are impacted as well. The behavior of children in these orphanages align with impacted areas of the brain as they show cognitive deficiencies and reactive behaviors. Unsurprisingly, the time a child spent in the institution affected the severity of the deficiencies. Children who were placed in foster care at a younger age had improved cognitive processing. But even if a child had decades of support after leaving the orphanage, the effects of a long orphanage stay were difficult to reverse. Conversely, when adoption occurred before 6 months of age, these children were able to regain normal cognitive and emotional functioning. While most children will not face neglect to the extent of the Romanian orphans, unfortunately, neglect is not uncommon. These horrific conditions and tragic outcomes have shown the long-lasting effects of deprivation, effects that we can see in the brain. This illustrates what the Center of Developing Child dubs the double whammy of neglect. Not only are neglected children not receiving the stimulation and enrichment that their young mind needs to develop, but their brains are also being bathed in stress hormones that are potentially dangerous to develop. These factors have a significant impact on their cognitive functioning and can follow them throughout their lives. The double whammy of neglect emphasizes that face-to-face interactions are extraordinarily important to child development. A major influence for this realization was Tronick's 1978 still face paradigm. In this study, a mother engages with her child face-to-face, smiling, talking, making eye contact, and gesturing. After this period, the adult becomes unresponsive to the child and maintains a neutral facial expression. Initially, the child makes attempts to regain the mother's attention by smiling or pointing, and it goes like this.
In the still face experiment, what the mother did was she sits down and she's playing with her baby who's about a year of age.
I'm like a girl. Oh.
And she gives a greeting to the baby. The baby gives a greeting back to her.
Yeah.
This baby starts pointing at different places in the world, and the mother's trying to engage her and play with her. They're working to coordinate their emotions and their intentions, what they want to do in the world. And that's really what the baby is used to. And then we ask the mother to not respond to the baby. The baby very quickly picks up on this. And then she uses all of her abilities to try and get the mother back. She smiles at the mother. She points because she's used to the mother looking where she points.
Yeah.
The baby puts both hands up in front of her and says, "What's happening here?" She makes that screechy sound at the mother, like, "Come on, why aren't we doing this?" Even in this 2 minutes, when they don't get the normal reaction, they react with negative emotions, they turn away, they feel the stress of it, they actually may lose control of their posture because of the stress that they're experiencing. It's a little like the good, the bad, and the ugly. The good is that normal stuff that goes on, that we all do with our kids. The bad is when something bad happens, but the infant can overcome it. After all, when you stop the still face, the mother and the baby start to play again. The ugly is when you don't give the child any chance to get back to the good. There's no reparation, and they're stuck in that really ugly situation.
The still face experiment was remarkable for its time, but when it first came out, people wondered if the researchers were reading too much into the child's reaction. In another iteration of the study using toddlers instead of infants, the toddlers showed the same response, only intensified in accordance with their development. They showed the same pattern of working to regain the mother's attention, becoming emotional, and then turning their head away. Critics' worries were thus quelled by the toddler's greater development and therefore intention. Before this experiment, the common narrative was that babies are too young to meaningfully engage and interact with adults. But this paradigm demonstrates that even babies seek emotional connection. This study, like many others, has been similarly used to uphold the rigid parental expectations that I was discussing earlier. There are so many reasons why a parent might not be able to fully engage with their child beyond they just don't care. A parent living in poverty may be too busy trying to make ends meet. A parent may have an illness or injury that prevents this level of emotional engagement. For parents and children living with a domestically violent partner, it may not be possible to show emotional reactions. There are also parents who struggle with mental health or postpartum depression, and they may not have the bandwidth to care for their child beyond their basic needs. As I mentioned earlier, we are very quick to condemn people rather than consider their circumstances, especially when these factors largely affect vulnerable groups. And this is why I advocate for high-quality child care to fill these gaps. I think every child should have access to good child care, especially those who are largely affected by these risk factors. But how do we know that daycare can help remedy some of these issues? A lot of the literature about this topic narrows in on socioeconomically disadvantaged families, or SED families. SED is similar to socioeconomic status, SES, but it encapsulates more. While SES typically refers to one's occupation, income, and education, SED includes aspects such as subjective social position, prolonged presence of stressors, family chaos, poor neighborhoods, and community violence. This is a group that is vulnerable to the risk factors that I mentioned earlier. Because of these experiences, SED families handle adversity differently than non-SED families. We have seen that despite feeling less capable in disciplinary settings, SED parents may be more likely to use harsh disciplinary actions. Given this stressor and the various other stressors associated with SED, these children are at a higher risk for hypothalamic pituitary adrenocortical axis dysregulation, or HPA dysregulation. This means cortisol, the stress hormone, is being released abnormally. Ideally, the release of cortisol follows a diurnal pattern, with cortisol levels peaking shortly after waking up and then dissipating throughout the day. In cases of trauma, these people's cortisol follows an abnormal rhythm. The Romanian orphans experience this very phenomenon. HPA axis dysregulation is one of the most consistent biological correlates for psychopathology, and it's not uncommon for kids in foster care, kids growing up in poverty, or people in traumatic situations. So how does this relate to what we've been talking about with daycare? As I said in the last episode, the quality of childcare really varies across the board. And it's no surprise that children in lower quality childcare facilities tend to have higher cortisol levels than children who are placed in higher quality facilities. Now, again, these studies are correlational, so that doesn't necessarily mean the daycares themselves are causing these levels of cortisol. Without a clear answer, researchers hypothesize that high-quality childcare is what is needed to combat high cortisol levels associated with SED families. It seems that attachment to the faculty staff is key in one study, with the results suggesting that a secure attachment to a care provider can predict lower cortisol levels within a week. Not only this, but high-quality care facilities can improve cognition in low-income children. The particular study I'm referencing was regarding low SES children's language acquisition. Some people feared that separating a child from their mother would result in a detriment to the child's language and cognitive development. This theory is called the loss resources hypothesis. But the results of this study suggested otherwise. The hypothesis that prevailed from the research is the compensatory hypothesis, and it suggests that not only does a care center lessen the negative effects of insecure attachment, but they also foster language and cognitive development by providing children with stimulating environments. I want to emphasize the importance of this by going back to talking about risk and protective factors. Poverty, low parental education, and disadvantaged neighborhoods possess a high degree of multifinality, meaning they're correlated with many future problems. Care facilities that are accessible to low-income neighborhoods target two of these, poverty and disadvantaged neighborhoods. Daycare can both alleviate stress from the parent and provide children with resources that they wouldn't otherwise have access to. And when we protect individuals through these services, we strengthen our communities. However, the people with the most risk often can't access these high-quality services. So in our next episode, we're going to be talking about Head Start, which is a government-funded program providing free childcare for low-income families, and we'll compare these services to tuition-based services. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Daycare Diaries. I'll see you next time.